are, in some way, the thin end of the wedge that will put an end to this madness.
Leobardus clanked to the window, his squire scrambling along the floor behind him, struggling to hold a half-fastened greave in place. The gravid sky did indeed show long, rippled streaks of blue, as if Cranhir's dark and bulky cliffs, looming over the bay where Leobardus' flagship, Ametin's Jewel, rolled at close anchor, caught and tore at the lowering clouds. Veligis, a great round man in golden escritorial robes, stumped to the window to stand at the Duke's side.
"How, my lord, can throwing oil on the fire help to extinguish it? It is, if you will pardon my forwardness, folly to think so."
The hammering of the muster drum echoed across the water. Leobardus brushed lank white hair out of his eyes.
"I know how the lector feels," he said, "and I know he directs you, beloved escritor, to try and persuade me out of this. His sacredness love of peace. Well, it is admirable, but it will not come about by talking."
Veligis opened a small brass casket and shook out a sugar sweet, which he delicately placed on his tongue.
"This is perilously close to sacrilege, Duke Leobardus. His prayer, talking, is the intercession of his sacredness, the lectoress, in somehow of less validity than the force of your armies? If that is so, then our faith in the word of Osiris and of his first acolyte, Sutrines, is a mockery."
The escritor sighed heavily and sucked. The Duke's cheeks pinkened. He waved the squire away, bending creakily to fasten the last buckle himself, then waved for his surcoat of rich blue, with a Benadryvine kingfisher gold-blazoned on the chest.
"God bless me, Veligis," he said testily, "but I haven't the mind for arguing with you today. I have been pushed too far by the High King Elias, and now I must do what is needed."
"But you do not go into battle by yourself,"
the large man said, speaking with some heat for the first time. "You lead hundreds, nay, thousands of men, of souls, and their well-being is in your care. The seeds of catastrophe are fluttering in the wind, and Mother Church has a responsibility to see they do not find fertile soil."
Leobardus shook his head sadly as the small page shyly lifted his golden helmet and its crest of blue-dyed horsehair.
"Fertile soil is everywhere these days, Veligis, and catastrophe is already growing, if you'll forgive my theft of your poetic words. The thing is, we must try and nip it while it is budding. Come."
He patted the escritor's fleshy arm.
"It is time to go down to the landing boat. Walk with me."
"Certainly, my good Duke, certainly."
Veligis turned slightly to the side, to ease through the narrow doorway.
"You will forgive me if I do not accompany you ashore just yet. I have been somewhat unsteady on my legs of late. I am getting old, I fear."
"Ah, but your rhetoric has not lost its vigor,"
Leobardus replied as they moved slowly across the deck. A small figure wrapped in a dark robe crossed his path, pausing to nod briefly, hands folded on its breast. The escritor frowned, but Duke Leobardus returned the nod with a smile.
"Ninresu has been with Emetin's Jewel a long time," he said, "and she is the finest of sea-watchers. I forgive her the formalities. Niskis are strange folk anyway, Veligis, as you would know if you were a sailing man. Come, my boat is this way."
The harbor wind made of Leobardus' cloak a sail, billowing blue against the uncertain sky. Leobardus saw his youngest son, Varellan, waiting at landfall, looking too small to fill out his gleaming armor. His thin face peered anxiously from the hollow of his helmet, while he surveyed the gathering Navene forces, as if his father might hold him responsible for any slipshod formations among the milling, swearing soldiers. Several of them pushed past him, as unconcernedly as if he were the drummer boy, cursing cheerfully at a pair of horses, who, frightened by the confusion, had leaped off the gangplank into the shallow water, taking their handler with them. Varellen backed away from the splashing, whinnying chaos, his forehead wrinkled in a frown that did not go away even when he saw the Duke step from the grounded boat and wade the last few paces to the rocky shore of Hernesteer's south coast.
"My lord," he said and hesitated.
Leobardus guessed he was wondering whether to climb down from his horse and bend a knee. The Duke had to restrain a scowl. He blamed Nessalanta for the boy's timidity, since she had hung on to him as a drunkard to his jug, unwilling to admit that the last of her children was grown. Of course, he perhaps owned some responsibility himself. He should never have poked fun at the boy's half-formed interest in the priesthood. Still, that had been years ago, and there was no turning the boy's path now. He would be a soldier if it killed him.
"So, Varellen," he said, and looked around. "Well then, my son, it looks as though all is in good order."
Although the evidence of his eyes told him his father was either mad or overkind, the young man flashed a grateful smile.
"We shall be unshipped in 2 hours, I would say. Will we march tonight?"
"After a week at sea, the men would kill us both and find a new ducal family. Although I suppose they would have to dispatch Benegaris, too, if they wanted to finish the line. Speaking of your brother, why is he not here?"
He spoke lightly, but he found the absence of his eldest child irritating. After weeks of bitter argument over whether Naban should cling to neutrality, and a stormy reaction to the Duke's decision to support Joshua, Benegaris had turned his coat and announced his desire to ride with his father and the armies. Benegaris could not give up an opportunity to lead the legions of the Kingfisher in battle, the Duke felt sure, even if it meant giving up a chance to rest his hocks for a short while, on the throne of the Sankelen Magistravis. He realized he was wool-gathering.
"No, no, Varellen. We must give the men a night in Cranhir, although merrymaking may prove scarce with Loth's war gone so poorly to the north. Where did you say Benegaris was?"
Varellen colored.
"I didn't, my lord. I'm sorry. He rode up to the town with his friend, Count Aspites Brevis."
Leobardus ignored his son's discomfort.
"By the tree, I would not have thought it too much to expect my son and heir to meet me. Well, so, let us go and see how things are with our other commanders."
He snapped his fingers, and the squire brought the Duke's horse up, harness bells jingling. They found Mylene sawing Gadaris underneath his house's white and red albatross banner. The old man, who had been Leobardus' cordial enemy for years, hailed the Duke over. He and Varellen sat watching as Mylene oversaw the final unloading of his two carracks, then joined the old earl in his striped tent for a flagon of sweet Ingadarine wine. After talking marching squares and futuring, and putting up with Varellen's half-successful attempts to join in, Leobardus thanked Earl Mylene for his hospitality and went out, youngest son trailing behind. Taking the reins back from their squires, they continued on through the bustling encampment, paying brief courtesy visits to the camps of some of the other nobles. The pair had just turned about to ride back up the strand, when the Duke caught sight of a familiar figure on a big-chested roan charger, sauntering down the road from town with another rider at his side. Benegaris' silver armor, his most cherished possession, was so thick with engravings and costly tracings of Illanite inlay that light declined to reflect from it properly, making it appear almost grey. Corseted by his breastplate, which corrected the overabundancy of his figure, Benegaris looked every inch a brave and doughty knight. Young Aspites beside him also wore armor of beautiful workmanship. The family osprey crest had been inlaid on his breastplate in mother of pearl. He wore no surcoat that might cover it up, but went like Benegaris, plated all over like a gleaming crab. Benegaris said something to his companion. Aspites Preves laughed, then rode away. Benegaris came down the road, crunching across the gravelly beach toward his father and younger brother.
That was Count Aspites, was it not?
Leobardus asked, trying to keep the bitterness he felt in the back of his throat from his voice.
Is the Praven House now become our enemy that he cannot come and salute his duke?
Benegaris leaned over in his saddle and patted his horse's neck. Leobardus could not see if he looked up through his thick, dark brows.
I told Aspites that you and I would speak privately, father. He would have come, but I sent him away. He went out of respect for you.
He turned to Varellan, who looked to swim in his bright armor, and gave the boy a brief nod. Feeling slightly overbalanced, the duke changed the subject.
What took you to town, my son? News, sire. I thought Aspites, since he has been here before, might help me to gather useful tidings. You were gone a long time.
Leobardus could not summon the strength to be angry.
What did you find, Benegaris? Anything? Nothing we had not already heard from the Abane Gate boats. Luth is wounded and has fallen back to the mountains. Skali controls Harnizadark, but has not the armies to extend himself any farther. Not until the Hernestirmen in the Grianspog have been subdued. So, the coast is yet free. And all the ground this side of the Ach Samrath, Nad Mullach, Cruvne, all the river lands up to Inniscrick.
Leobardus rubbed his head, squinting at the glaring streak the sun made on the surface of the ocean.
Perhaps we could best serve Prince Joshua if we were to break this nearer siege, if we were to bring our 2,000 men against Skali Sharpnose's back. Luth's armies would be freed up, what's left of them. And Elias' back would be naked as he lays siege to the Naglamund.
He weighed the plan and liked it. It seemed to him something his brother Camaris might have done. Swift, forceful, a stroke like a snapping whip. Camaris had always approached warfare like the pure weapon he was, as straightforward and unhesitating as a shining hammer. Benegaris was shaking his head, something like real alarm on his face.
Oh no, sire, no! Why, if we were to do that, all Skali would have to do is melt into the Kirkoil or climb up into the same Grianspog mountains. Then we would be pegged down like a stretched hide, waiting for the Rimmer's men to come out. Meanwhile, Elias would reduce Naglamund and be free to turn on us. We would be cracked like a hazelnut between the High King and the Raven.
He shook his head emphatically, as if the idea frightened him. Leobardus turned away from the dazzling sun.
I suppose you make good sense, Benegaris, although I seem to remember you arguing differently not long ago.
That was until you made your decision to put the army in the field, my lord.
Benegaris lifted his helmet and rolled it in his hands for a moment, before hanging it back on his pommel.
Now that we are committed, I am a Nascadu lion.
Leobardus took a deep breath. The tang of war was in the air, and it was a scent that filled him with unease and regret. Still, the sundering of Ost and Ard after the long years of John's peace, the High King's ward, seemed to have brought his headstrong son back to his side. It was something for which to be grateful, however insignificant in the tide of greater events. The Duke of Naban offered a silent prayer of thanks to his confusing but ultimately beneficent God.
Praise Osiris Aedon for bringing you back to us, Iskrimnos said and felt tears coming again.
He leaned over the bed and gave Isorn's shoulder a rough, joyful shake, earning a sharp glance from Gutrun, who had not left her grown son's side since he had come in the night before. Isorn, no stranger to his mother's stern ways, grinned weakly up at Iskrimnor. He had the duke's blue eyes and broad features, but much of the sheen of youth seemed to have vanished since his father had seen him last. He was drawn, shadowed. Something seemed to have been drained from him for all his stock-shouldered bulk.
It's just hardship and worry that's been at him, the duke decided. He's a strong boy. Look at him. How he puts up with his mother's fussing. He'll be a fine man. No, he is a fine man. when he's Duke after me, after we send Scarly shouting down to hell.
His son! A new voice sent the errant thought fluttering away. It is a miracle to have you back among us. Prince Joshua leaned forward and clasped Isorn's hand with his own left hand. Gutrun nodded approvingly. She did not rise to curtsy to the prince, motherhood apparently overriding manners on this occasion. Joshua did not seem to mind.
The devil is its miracle, Escrimnor said gruffly,
and frowned to keep his swelling heart from causing him any embarrassment.
He got him out through wits and courage, and that's God's truth.
Escrimnor,
Gutrun warned him. Joshua laughed.
Of course. Let me say then, Isorn, that your courage and wit were miraculous.
Isorn sat higher in the bed, readjusting the bandaged leg that lay pillowed atop the coverlet, like the relic of a saint.
That's far too kind, your highness. Had not some of Scarly's cold striker men been without the stomach for torture of their fellows, we would be there still, as eye-stiffened corpses.
Isorn, his mother said, annoyed. Do not speak of such things. It flies in the face of God's mercy.
But it's true, mother. Scarly's own ravens gave us the knives that permitted our escape.
He turned to Joshua.
There are dark things afoot in Elvid's Hollow. Over all of Rimmersgard, Prince Joshua, you must believe me. Scarly is not alone. The town was full of black Rimmersmen out of the lands around Stormspike. It was them that Sharpnose left to guard us. It was those God-cursed monsters who tortured our men for nothing. We had nothing to hide from them. They did it for pleasure, if such a thing can be imagined. Nights we went to sleep hearing the cries of our fellows, wondering who they would take next.
He moaned softly, and lifted his hand from Gutrun's restraining grasp to rub at his temples, as if to scour the memory.
Even Scarly's own men found it sickening. I think they are beginning to wonder what their thane has gotten them into.
We believe you, Joshua said gently. The look he lifted to standing as Grimnor was etched with worry.
But there were others too. Ones who came by night, hooded in black. Even our guards did not see their faces.
Although Asorn's voice remained quiet, his eyes were round in the remembering.
They did not even move like men. The Aedhon be my witness. They were out of the cold wastes beyond the mountains. We could feel the chill of them as they passed our prison. We were more frightened of being near to them than of all the Black Rimmersmen's hot irons.
Asorn shook his head and lay back on the pillow.
I'm sorry, father. Prince Joshua, I'm very tired.
He is a strong man, Escrimnor,
the prince said as they walked up the puddled corridor. The roof here was leaking, as so many were in Naglamund after a winter of hard weather, and a spring and summer of the same.
I only wish I had not left him alone to face that horse and Scarly. Be damned!
Skidding on the wet stone, Escrimnor cursed his age and clumsiness.
He did all that could be done, uncle.
You should be proud of him.
I am.
They walked on for a while before Joshua spoke.
I must confess having Isorn here makes it easier for me to ask of you what I must ask.
Escrimnor tugged at his beard.
And what is that?
A boon.
One that I would not beg if... He hesitated.
No. Let us go to my chamber. This is a thing that should be discussed in solitude.
He hooked his right arm through the Duke's elbow, the leather-capped stump on his wrist a mute reproach in advance of any rejection. Escrimnor tugged at his beard again until it hurt. He had a feeling he would not like what he was about to hear.
By the tree, let's get a jug of wine to take with us, Joshua. I sorely need it. For the love of Osiris, by the crimson mallet of Dror, the bones of St. Aelstan and St. Scandi, are you mad? Why should I leave Naglamund?
Escrimnor trembled in surprise and anger.
I would not ask it if there was any other way, Escrimnor.
The prince spoke patiently, but even through the mist of his rage, the duke could see the anguish Joshua felt.
I have lain awake two nights without sleep, trying to think of another way. I cannot. Somebody must find the Princess Miriamel.
Isgrimnor took a long swallow of wine, feeling some dribble down his beard but not caring.
Why?
He said at last, and set the jar down with a table-rattling thump.
And why me, goddamn it all? Why me?
The prince was all strained patience.
She must be found because she is vitally important,
as well as my only niece.
What if I die, Isgrimnor? What if we hold off Elias, break the siege, but I stop an arrow or tumble from the castle wall? Who will the people rally behind? Not just the barons and the warlords, but the common people, those who came flocking into my walls for protection. It will be hard enough to fight Elias with me at your head, strange and fickle as I am thought. But what if I die?
Isgrimnor stared at the floor.
There is Luth and Leobardus.
Joshua shook his head harshly.
King Luth is wounded, maybe dying. Leobardus is the Duke of Naban, at war with Erkinland within the memory of some.
The Sankelen itself is a reminder of a time when Naban ruled all, even you, uncle. Good and much respected man as you are, could not hold a force together that would stand against Elias.
He is a son of Prester John. He was raised to the Dragonbone chair by John himself. For all his wicked deeds, it will take someone from the family to unseat him, and you know it.
Isgrimnor's long silence was his answer.
But why me? He said at last. Because Miriamel would not come back for anyone else I could send. Deornoth, he is as brave and as loyal as a hunting hawk. But he would have to carry the princess back to Naglamund in a sack. Beside myself, you were the only one who could ever bring her unresisting. And she must come willingly, for it would be disaster if you were found out. Soon enough Elias may discover she is gone, and then he will set the south afire to find her.
Joshua walked to his desk and absently ruffled a stack of parchments.
Think carefully, Isgrimnor. Forget for a moment that it is yourself we speak of. Who else has traveled as far and has as many friends in strange places? Who else, if you will forgive me, has seen the wrong end of so many dark alleys in Ancis Pelipe and Naban?
Isgrimnor grinned sourly in spite of himself.
But still it makes no sense, Joshua. How can I leave my men with Elias coming against us? And how could I hope to perform such a secret thing, well known as I am?
For the first, that is why it seems to me a sign from God that Isorn has come. Ein Skaldir, we both would agree, has not the restraint to command. Isorn does.
Anyway, uncle, he deserves the chance to make good. Elritzala's fall has battered his young pride.
It's battered pride that makes a boy a man, the duke growled. Go on.
As to the second, well, you are well known, but you have been seldom south of Erkinland in 20 years. In any case, we shall disguise you.
Disguise?
Isgrimnor pawed distractedly at the braids of his beard, as Joshua walked to his chamber door and called out. The duke had a strange heavy feeling around his heart. He had been dreading the fight, not so much for himself as for his people, his wife. Now his son was here too, giving him another stone of worry to carry. But to leave, even riding into danger as great as he left behind, it seemed unsupportably like cowardice, like treason.
But I was sworn to Joshua's father, my dear old John. How can I not do what his son asks? And his arguments make all too much bedamned sense.
Here,
the prince said, stepping away from the door to allow someone in. It was Father Strangyard, his pink eye-patched face creased in a shy smile. Tall frame stooped over his burden, a bundle of dark cloth.
I hope it fits, he said. They seldom do. I don't know why, just another gentle reminder. Another of the master's little burdens.
He trailed off, then seemed to find the thread again.
Eglaf was most kind to lend it. He is about your size, I think, although not quite so tall.
Eglaf, Iskrimnor said, mystified. Who is Eglaf, Joshua? What is this nonsense?
Brother Eglaf, of course, Strangyard explained.
Your disguise, Iskrimnor, Joshua amplified. The castle archivist shook out the bundle, revealing a woolen set of black priestly vestments.
You are a devout man, uncle, the prince said. I am sure you will be able to carry it off.
The duke could have sworn Joshua was resisting a smile.
What? Priest's robes?
Iskrimnor was beginning to see the outlines of the thing, and he was not pleased. How better to pass unnoticed in Navan, where Mother Church is queen, and priests of every stripe nearly outnumber the rest of the citizens? Joshua was smiling. Iskrimnor was furious.
Joshua, I feared for your wits before, but now I know you have lost them completely. This is the maddest scheme I have ever seen. And on top of everything else, whoever heard of an Aedonite priest with a beard?
He snorted scornfully. The prince, with a warning glance to Father Strangyard, who put the robes down on a chair and back toward the door, walked to his table and lifted a cloth, revealing a basin of hot water and a gleaming, fresh-stropped razor. The Scrimnor's eruptive bellow rattled the very crockery in the castle kitchen below.
Speak, mortal man. Do you come to our hills as spies?
A chilly silence followed Prince Jariki's words. From the corner of his eye, Simon watched Hasten reach backward, feeling along the wall for something to use as a weapon. Sludig and Grimrik glared at the Scythi who surrounded them, certain that any moment they would be set upon.
No, Prince Jariki,
Binnabik said hastily.
Surely you are seeing. We had no expectations of finding your people here. We are from Neklimund, Prince Joshua's sending, on an errand of terrible import. We are seeking...
The troll hesitated, as though afraid to say too much. Finally, with a shrug, he continued.
We go to the Dragon Mountain for searching Kamare So Venita's sword, Thorn.
Jariki narrowed his eyes. And behind him, the green-clad one he had called his uncle let out a thin whistle of breath.
What would you do with such a thing?
Kendraja Aro demanded. Binnabik would not answer this, but stared unhappily at the cavern floor. The very air seemed to thicken as the moments passed.
It's to save us from Inaluki, the Storm King, Simon blurted out.
None of the Scythi moved a muscle except to blink. No one said a word.
Speak more, Jariki said at last. If we must, Binnabik said. It is part of a story, near as long as your Oakiza Tomete ne Rianis, the song of the fall of Tometai. We will try for telling you what we can.
The troll hurriedly explained the main facts. It seemed to Simon that he deliberately omitted many things. Once or twice in the telling, Binnabik looked up and caught his eye, seemingly warning him to silence. Binnabik told the silent Scythi of Naglimund's preparations and the crimes of the High King. He explained the words of Yarnauge and the Book of Nisse's, reciting the rhyme that led them on toward Urmsheim. The finish of the story left the troll facing Jariki's bland stare, the uncle's more skeptical expression, and a silence so complete that the ringing echo of the waterfall seemed to swell until it filled the whole world with noise. What a place of madness and dreams this was, and what a mad story they were suddenly living in. Simon felt his heart racing, but not from fear alone.
This is hard to credit, son of my sister.
Kendraja Haro said at last, spreading his beringed hands in an unfamiliar gesture.
It is, uncle, but I think this is not the time to speak of it. But the other one the boy spoke of,
Kendraja Haro began, his yellow eyes troubled, his voice full of building anger.
The black one below Nakika. Not now.
There was an edge to the Scythi prince's voice. He turned to the five outsiders.
Apologies are called for. It is not good that we should discuss such things while you still have not eaten. You are our guests.
Simon felt a wave of relief at these words and swayed a little, his knees suddenly weak. Noticing this, Jiriki waved them toward the fire.
Sit down. We must be forgiven for our suspicion. Understand, although I owe you blood debt, Sio Man, you are my Hikastaja. Your race has done ours little kindness. I must be disagreeing with you in a part, Prince Jiriki,
Binnabik replied, seating himself on a flat rock near the fire.
Of all Sithi, your family should be knowing that we Kanuk have never brought you any harm.
Jiriki looked down on the little man, and his taut features relaxed into an expression almost of fondness.
You have caught me in ungraciousness, Binbinike Gabenik. After only the Western men, whom we knew best, we once loved the Kanuk. Well?
Binnabik lifted his head, a look of astonishment on his round face.
How are you knowing my full name? I have not given mention of it, and my companions have not been either.
Jiriki laughed, a hissing sound, but strangely cheering, with not a hint of insincerity. In that moment, Simon felt a fierce, sudden liking for him.
Ah, troll, the prince said. Someone as traveled as you are should not be surprised that your name is known. How many Kanuk beside your master and yourself are ever seen south of the mountains? You were knowing my master? He is dead now.
Binnabik pulled off his gloves and flexed his fingers. Simon and the others were finding seats of their own.
He knew us, Jiriki said. Did he not teach you to speak our language? You said the troll spoke to you, Anne? He did, my prince, mostly correctly.
Binnabik flushed, pleased but embarrassed.
Okekok was teaching me Sam, but he never told me where he had been learning it. I had the thought perhaps his master had given it to him. Sit now, sit,
said Jiriki, gesturing for Hasten, Sludig, and Grimrik to follow Simon and Binnabik's example. They came like dogs who fear a beating and found themselves places near the fire. Several of the other Sithi approached, bearing salvers of intricately carved and polished wood, high laden with all manner of things, butter and dark brown bread, a wheel of pungent salty cheese, small red and yellow fruits that Simon had never seen before. There were also several bowls of quite recognizable berries, and even a pile of slow-dripping honeycombs. When Simon reached and took two of the sticky combs, Jiriki laughed again, a quiet sibilance like a jay in a distant tree.
Everywhere is winter, he said, but in the sheltered fastnesses of Zhao E Tenokai, the beasts do not know it. Take all you like.
Captors turned hosts now served the companions an unfamiliar but potent wine, filling their wooden goblets from stone ewers. Simon wondered if some prayer might be said before starting, but the Sithi had already begun to eat. Hasten, Sludig, and Grimrik were looking around miserably, wanting to begin, but still full of fear and distrust. They watched intently as Binnabik broke bread and took a mouthful of buttered crust. Some moments later, when he was not only still alive, but eating merrily, the men felt safe to attack the Sithi fair, which they did with the vigor of reprieved prisoners. Dabbing honey from his chin, Simon paused to watch the Sithi. The fair folk ate slowly, sometimes staring at a berry between their fingers for long instants before lifting it to their mouths. There was little speech, but when one of them made some remark in their liquid tongue or gave voice to a brief trill of song, all the others listened. Most often there was no response, but if one of them had some answer, they all listened to that, too. There was much quiet laughter, but no shouting and no arguing. and Simon never heard anyone interrupt while another was speaking. Anne had moved over to sit near Simon and Binnabik. One of the Scythi made a solemn statement that drew a laugh from the others. Simon asked Anne to explain the joke. The white-jacketed Scyther looked slightly uncomfortable.
Kiyoshapo, sit at your friend's seat, as though they fear their food might run away.
He gestured to Hasten, who was pushing food into his mouth with both hands. Simon was not sure what Anne meant. Surely they had seen hungry people before. But he smiled anyway. As the meal wore on, and a seemingly inexhaustible river of wine replenished the wooden goblets, the Rimmer's man and the two Erkinlandish guardsmen began to enjoy themselves. At one point, Sludig stood, tumbler sloshing in his hand, and proposed a hearty toast to his new Scythi friends. Jeriki smiled and nodded. But Kendra Jaharo stiffened. When Sludig swung into an old northern drinking song, the prince's uncle slipped quietly off to the corner of the broad cavern to stare into the rippling, lamplit pond. The other Scythi at table laughed as Sludig sang the choruses in his braying voice and swayed to his tipsy rhythm, whispering occasionally among themselves. Sludig and Hasten and Grimrik seemed quite happy now, and even Binnabik was grinning as he sucked on a pear rind. But Simon, remembering the enthralling music he had heard the Scythi play, felt a glow of shame for his companion, as though the Rimmer's man were a festival bear, dancing for crumbs in main row. After watching for some while, he got up, wiping his hands on his shirt front. Binnabik rose too, and after asking Jeriki's permission, went down the covered passageway to have a look after Kantaka. The three soldiers were all laughing uproariously among themselves. Telling Simon had no doubt drunken soldier jokes, he walked to one of the wall niches to examine the strange lamps. Abruptly he was reminded of the glowing crystal Morghenes had given him. Could it have been Scythi work? And felt a cold, lonely tug at his heart. He lifted one of the lamps and saw a faint shadow of the bones in his hand, as though the flesh was only muddied water. Stare as he might, he could not fathom how the flame had been introduced to the inside of the translucent crystal. Sensing someone watching, he turned. Jeriki was staring, cat eyes agleam on the far side of the fire circle. Simon started, surprised. The prince nodded. Hasten, the wine gone to his shaggy head, had challenged one of the Scythi, the one Anne had named Kiyoshapo, to wrist wrestle. Kiyoshapo, yellow-braided, dressed in black and grey, was receiving drunken advice from Grimrik. It was clear why the skinny guardsman thought his aid well-directed. The Scyther was a head shorter than Hasten, and looked to be barely more than half his weight. As the Scyther, with a bemused expression, leaned forward across the smooth stone to clasp Hasten's broad hand, Jeriki stood up and edged past them, making his graceful way across the chamber towards Simon. It was still difficult, Simon thought, to reconcile this confident, clever being with the maddened creature he had found in the Cotsman's wire. Still, when Jeriki turned his head a certain way or flexed his long, jointed fingers, it was possible to see again the wildness that had frightened and fascinated. And whenever the firelight caught the prince's gold-flecked, amber eyes, they shone ancient as jewels from the black soil of the forest.
Come, Seoman, the Scyther said. I will show you something.
He slid his hand under the youth's elbow and steered him toward the pool where Kendra Jaharo sat trailing his fingers in the water. As they passed the fire, Simon saw that the wrist-wrestling contest was at full heat. The opponents were locked in struggle, neither with an advantage yet, but Hasten's bearded face was clenched in a lock-toothed grin of strain. The slender Scyther, by contrast, showed little effect from the standoff, except his grey-clad arm quivering with the tension of their striving. Simon did not think this boded well for Hasten's chances. Sludig, watching the small frustrate the large, sat open-mouthed. Jeriki fluted something to his uncle as they approached, but Kendra Jaharo did not respond. His ageless face seemed closed, shut like a door. Simon followed the prince past him along the cavern wall. A moment later, before his astonished eyes, Jariki disappeared. He had only stepped into another tunnel, one that hooked around behind the stone sluice of the little waterfall. Simon went in after him. The tunnel curled upward in rough stone steps, lit by a row of lamps.
"Follow me, please," Jariki said, and began to climb.
It seemed they mounted far up into the hill, spiraling around and around for some time. At last they passed the last lamp, and traveled a careful way in near darkness, until finally Simon became aware of the gleam of stars before him. A moment later the passageway widened into a small cave, one end of which was open to the night sky. He followed Jariki to the cavern's edge, which was a waist-high lip of stone. The rock face of the hill dropped away below. 10 bare cubits down to the tops of the tall evergreens, 50 more to the snow-matted ground. The night was clear, the stars shining fiercely against the blackness, and the forest was all around like a vast secret. After they had stood some while, Jariki said,
"I owe you a life, man-child. Do not fear, I will forget."
Simon said nothing, afraid to speak in case he should break the spell that allowed him to stand in the very midst of the forest night, a spy in God's dark garden. An owl called. There passed another interval of silence. Then the Cither lightly touched Simon's arm and pointed out above the silent ocean of trees.
"There, to the north, beneath Loyes's staff."
He indicated a line of 3 stars in the lowest part of the velvety sky.
"Can you see the outline of the mountains?"
Simon stared. He thought there might be a faint luminescence on the murky horizon, the barest hint of some great white shape so far away as to seem out of reach of the same moonlight that glowed on trees and snow beneath them.
"I think so," he said quietly. "That is where you go. The peak men call Urmsheim is in that range, although you would need a clearer night to see it well."
He sighed.
"Your friend, Binabik, tonight spoke of lost Tomete. Once it could be seen from here, away there in the east."
He pointed into the darkness.
"From this very perch. But that was in my great-grandfather's day. In daylight, the Seni Anzin, the Tower of the Walking Dawn, would catch the rising sun in its roofs of crystal and gold. They say it was like a beautiful torch burning on the morning horizon."
He broke off, turning his eyes finally to Simon, the rest of his face obscured by night shadow.
"Tomate is long buried," he said, and shrugged. "Nothing lasts, not even the Scythi, not even time itself."
How old are you?"
Jariki smiled, teeth glinting in the moonlight.
"Older than you, Seoman. Let us go down now. You have seen and survived many things today, and no doubt you need sleep."
When they got back to the firelit cavern, the 3 guardsmen were wrapped in their cloaks, snoring lustily. Binabik had returned and sat listening as several Scythi sang a slow, mournful song that droned like a beehive and ran like a river and seemed to fill the cave like the thick scent of some rare, dying flower. Curled in his own cloak, watching the firelight flicker on the stones above him, Simon was lulled to sleep by the strange music of Jariki's tribe. Chapter 39 High King's Hand. Simon awakened to find the cavern light changed. The fire still burned, thin yellow flames among the white ashes. But the lamps had been extinguished. Daylight filtered down through crevices in the ceiling that had been invisible the night before, transforming the stone chamber into a pillared hall of light and shadow. His three soldier companions still slept, tangled in their cloaks, snoring, sprawled like battle casualties. The cavern was otherwise empty, but for Binnabik, who sat cross-legged before the fire, tootling absently on his walking stick flute. Simon sat up groggily.
"Where are the city?"
Binnabik did not turn, but piped a few more notes.
"Greetings, good friend," he said at last. "Was your sleep satisfying?"
"I suppose," Simon grunted, rolling back over to stare at the dust flecks shimmering near the cavern's roof.
"Where did the city go?"
"Out for hunting, as it were. Come and raise yourself. I need your assistance."
Simon groaned, but dragged himself up into a sitting position.
"Hunting for giants?"
he asked a short while later through a mouthful of fruit. Hasten's snores were becoming so loud that Binnabik had put his flute down in disgust.
"Hunting whatever is threatening to their borders, I suppose."
The troll stared at something before him on the stone cavern floor.
"Kekasut, this is making no good sense. I am not liking it one least bit."
"What doesn't make sense?"
Simon lazily surveyed the rock chamber.
"Is this a Scythi house?"
Binnabik looked over, frowning.
"I suppose it is good you have regained your ability for the asking of many questions at once. No, this is not a Scythi house as such. It is, I am thinking, what Jiriki called it, a hunting lodge, a place for their hunters to stay while roaming afield. As for your other question, it is these bones that are nonsensical, or rather too much sense they make."
The knuckle bones lay in a heap before Binnabik's knees. Simon looked them over.
"What does that mean?"
"I will tell you. Perhaps it would be good you're using this time to wash the dirt and blood and juice of berries from your face."
The troll flashed a sour yellow grin, pointing to the pool in the corner.
"There is suitable for washing."
He waited until Simon had ducked his head once in the bitingly cold water.
"Ah," the youth said, shivering. "Cold."
"You may be seeing,"
Binnabik resumed, unperturbed by Simon's complaints,
"that I have been at throwing my bones this morning. What they are saying is this. The shadowed path, unwrapped dart, and black crevice. Much confusion and worry this is causing me."
"Why?"
Simon splashed more water on his face and rubbed it off with his jerkin sleeve, which was itself none too clean.
"Because I was casting the bones before we left Naglimon,"
Binnabik said crossly.
"And the same figures I was getting. Exactly."
"But why should that be bad?"
Something bright lying at the pool's edge caught his eye. He picked it up carefully and discovered it was a round looking glass set in a splendidly carved wooden frame. The rim of the dark glass was etched with unfamiliar characters.
"That it often is when things are always the same,"
Binnabik answered.
"But with the bones, it is more than that. The bones, to me, are guides to wisdom. Yes?"
"Mm-hmm,"
Simon polished the mirror on his shirt front.
"Well, what if you were opening your Book of the Aedon to discover that all its pages suddenly were having only one verse? The same verse, over then over."
"Do you mean a book I had already seen, that hadn't been like that before? I suppose it would be magic."
"Well then,"
Binnabik said, mollified,
"there you are seeing my problem. There are hundreds of ways the bones can find themselves. To be the same cast 6 times in running, I can only think it bad. Much as I have started, still I am not liking the word magic. But some force there is gripping the bones, as a powerful wind is pushing all flags the same way. Simon, are you listening?"
Staring fixedly at the mirror, Simon was astonished to find an unfamiliar face looking back. The stranger had an elongated, large-boned face, blue-shadowed eyes, and a growth of red-gold whiskers on chin, cheeks, and upper lip. Simon was further amazed to realize that, of course, he was only seeing himself, thinned and weathered by his travels, the first growth of man's beard darkening his jaws. What kind of face was this, he suddenly wondered. He still had not a man's features, worn and stern, but he fancied that he had sloughed off some of his mooncalfishness. Nonetheless, he found something disappointing in the long-chinned, shock-haired youth who stared back at him.
Is this what I looked like to Miriamelle? Like a farmer's son? A ploughboy?
And even as he thought of the princess, it seemed that he saw a flash of her features in the glass, almost growing out of his own. For a dizzy instant they were meshed together, like two cloudy souls in one body. An instant later it was Miriamelle alone whose face he saw. Or Malachias, rather, for her hair was short and black, and she wore boy's clothes. A colourless sky lay beyond her, spotted with dark thunderheads. There was another two, who stood just behind, a round-faced man in a grey hood. Simon had seen him before, he was sure, so sure. Who was he?
Simon!
Benedict's voice splashed him like the cold pool water, just as the elusive name flitted within reach. Startled, he juggled the mirror for a moment. When he clutched it tight again, no face was there but his own.
Are you turning sick?
The troll asked, worried by the slack, puzzled expression Simon turned toward him.
No, I don't think so.
Then if you are washed, come to help me. We shall go to speaking of the auguries later, when your attention is not so delicate.
Benedict stood, dropping the knuckle bones back into their leather sack. Benedict went first down the ice chute, warning Simon to keep his toes pointed and his hands close to his head. The headlong seconds rushing down the tunnel were like a dream of falling from a high place, and when he thumped down into the soft snow beneath the tunnel mouth, bright, chilled daylight in his eyes, he was content to sit for a moment and enjoy the feel of his heart's rapid beating. A moment later, he was bowled over by a surprising clout on the back, followed by the smothering descent of a mountain of muscle and fur.
Kantaka, he heard Benedict shout, laughing. If it is your friends who are receiving such treatment, I am glad I am no enemy.
Simon pushed the wolf away, gasping, only to face a renewed, rough-tongued assault on his face. At last, with Benedict's aid, he rolled free. Kantaka sprang to her feet, whining excitedly, circled the youth and troll once, then sprang away into the snowy wood.
Now,
Benedict said, brushing snow from his black hair,
we must be finding where the Scythi have been putting up our horses.
Not far, Kanukman.
Simon jumped. He turned to see a line of Scythi file silently out of the trees, Jariki's green-jacketed uncle at its head.
And why do you seek them?
Benedict smiled.
Certainly not for escaping you, good Kendra Jaharo. Your hospitality is too lavish for us to hurry away from it. No, there are certain things only I wish to make sure we still have. Things I was obtaining with some trouble at Naglamund, that we will need on the roads ahead.
Kendra Jaharo looked down on the troll expressionlessly for a moment, then signaled to two of the other Scythi.
Sejandi, Kiyoshapo, show them.
The yellow-haired pair walked a few steps along the hillside, away from the tunnel mouth, then stopped, waiting for Simon and the troll to follow. When Simon looked back, he saw Kendra Jaharo still watching, an unreadable expression in his bright, narrowed eyes. They found the horses put up a few furlongs away, in a small cavern, hidden by a pair of snow-laden pine trees. The cave was snug and dry. All six horses were contentedly chewing away at a pile of sweet-smelling hay.
Where did all this come from?
Simon asked, surprised.
We often bring our own horses,
Kiyoshapo replied, speaking the Western tongue carefully.
Does it surprise you to find we have a stable for them?
As Benedict rooted around in one of the saddlebags, Simon explored the cavern. noting the light spilling through a crevice high in the wall, and a stone trough filled with clean water. Propped against the far side was a pile of helmets, axes, and swords. Simon recognized one of the blades as his own, from the armory of Naglamund.
"These are ours, Binnabek," he said. "How did they get here?"
Kiyoshapo spoke slowly, as though to a child.
"We put them here after we took them from you and your companions. Here, they are safe and dry."
Simon looked at the Scyther suspiciously. "But I thought that you couldn't touch iron, that it was poison to you." He stopped short, fearful that he had ventured onto forbidden ground, but Kiyoshapo only exchanged a glance with his silent companion before replying.
"So, you have heard tales of the days of black iron," he said. "Yes, it was once thus, but those of us who survived those days have learned much. We know now what waters to drink, and from which certain springs, so that we can handle mortal iron for a little time without harm. Why did you think we allowed you to keep your coat of mail? But, of course, we have no liking for it, and do not use it, or even touch it when there is no need."
He looked over to Binnabek, who was still rummaging intently in the traveling bags.
"We shall leave you to finish your search," the Scyther said. "You will find nothing missing, at least nothing you had when you came into our hands."
Binnabek looked up.
"Of course," he said. "I am only in worry over things that may have been lost during the fighting of yesterday." "Of course,"
Kiyoshapo replied. He and the quiet Sejandi went out beneath the branches